You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and this week we witnessed the transfer of power in the United States, which was mourned by some and couldn't come quick enough for others. But we can't say this was a peaceful transfer of power based on the Capitol riots of just 2 weeks ago. My guest today makes the point in his new book that democracy's fragile fate depends on acceptance of the results of elections by the side that loses. He was talking about the Civil War in his latest book, which is our focus today, but he could just as well have been talking about modern politics. He's Nathan Calmo, Associate Professor of Political Communication at Louisiana State University and a former colleague of mine at Monmouth College. His book is called With Ballots and Bullets, Partisanship and Violence in the American Civil War. He provides some fascinating insights in politics and will change your mind on some long-held historical narratives we've been taught. He certainly did some of mine. Nathan, welcome, and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'll bet when you started writing this book, you had no idea that it was going to be so relevant to what's going on. What piqued your interest in this specific topic? I know you were involved with it when you were at Monmouth years ago and you had an interest in this, but what kind of led you to tackle this book that is so timely and relevant right now?
Yeah, I am trained in studying public opinion and political communication in the modern context of the United States, but I always had a fascination about American political history. And when I was in grad school at the University of Michigan getting my doctorate, I was doing lots of reading about Civil War history and the politics around that in particular. And at the same time, I was doing research on partisan polarization, among other topics, and I really saw a strong connection between the rising polarization, even at that time about a decade ago, and some of the dynamics that I was reading about in the Civil War histories by professional historians. And so I wanted to figure out a way to bring these two together, to bring some political science perspectives, which is my background, into analyzing the Civil War era politics, and of course building on the insights that historians have brought to that period. So kind of a hybrid project. And this is unusual for somebody in my position to be trying to bridge these gaps, but I saw it both as something I was extremely motivated to do because I had such a passion for American history, and also I thought that there was some real insights that could be drawn from history into our understanding of mass partisanship in the present and our broader theories and understandings of those dynamics, as well as some insights that we could add to history by bringing some political science perspectives there. So it was an opportunity to really pursue a passion of mine, but I also saw opportunities as well to contribute some new insights and some different ways of looking at the past as well as the present with this combined approach.
Well, I think you're very successful, and I recommend my listeners with anybody with an interest in politics and the Civil War will find this book really interesting. What was interesting to me right off was I didn't realize that, and I guess we take it for granted, but we did hold elections during the Civil War, and that played a role in kind of you able to track some of the theories or interests you had in how partisanship shaped the conduct of the war to a large degree, or perhaps the war shaped partisanship. But what was your major angle, I guess, having that information available on partisanship? What were you trying to look at to prove or disprove kind of your preconceived notions going in?
Yeah, I think everybody has a pretty good understanding that the major conflict motivating the Civil War was over the expansion of slavery. Democrats, and especially Southern Democrats at that time, were pushing to have slavery expand westward, in many cases without limits, and Republicans, the new party in basically only in the North, was trying to restrict slavery to the places where it already existed, since the Constitution, at least as it was interpreted, didn't allow them to mess with slavery in the places where it already existed. So what I wanted to do here is draw out that partisan divide that I mentioned, and the implications of the slavery divide also being a partisan divide for how people think and act about participation in politics, how they cast their votes, and even whether they make a decision to join up in a war to fight on behalf of the Union and its causes. So the big picture here is thinking about the role of ordinary partisans, ordinary people who identified with the Republican or Democratic Party in the North, and how that affected their decisions to get involved in the war, actually fighting it, and then how the experiences of the war affected the votes that were cast during the war. And an important point here that you mentioned is that quite remarkably, elections continued through the entirety of the Civil War, even in places where they were close to combat zones. In a couple of counties along the border, elections were being disrupted, but really remarkable in that elections were continued, and that it was a real priority of the Lincoln administration to do that, to demonstrate that democracy could still sustain itself, not just in putting down a rebellion against Lincoln's election. A lot of folks forget that was the impetus. The immediate impetus was Southern Democrats rejecting Lincoln's election as the first Republican president. But that electoral process could be continued in places that were not in rebellion throughout the course of the war, even at great difficulty.
It's interesting how political science has been really on top of this notion that fact that most voting is really comes down to your partisan feelings, and campaigns spend lots of money on consultants, and they really should pay a little more attention to the work that's been done, like what you've done, that the voting decision really comes mostly down to your partisan leanings. And this has been the case going back to even this era. You did an incredible amount of research, not only at the state level, at county level, on data that was available. How did folks' partisan leanings during the Civil War affect their voting? There's kind of a view that their voting was perhaps influenced by certain things going on during the war or whatever. Did that play any role?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about identifying a strong role for partisanship in the general public at this time is that we have to remember the Republican Party at that time was only a couple of years old. In the early 1850s is when it came about, and Lincoln is winning the 1860 presidential election. And so one of the conventional wisdoms that I push back against from this era is the idea that partisanship didn't matter all that much. In fact, you can see really strong continuity of how people were voting at the local level from the 1840s into the 1850s and even into the 1860s. So even though the party names were changing, the coalitions of people who were coming together to vote for one party or another were really quite stable, and that provides a grounding or a kind of stability for a stronger form of partisanship to be acting and motivating people on the individual level, as well as how they work together as communities for these collective projects like defeating a rebellion. One thing I want to be really clear about is individual people weren't motivated to fight in this war primarily because of their partisanship. But the people who they were responding to, the leaders who were giving them guidance on how to think about the war and the broader politics, were partisans. And people tended to trust and follow the leaders in their own party and to dismiss what the partisan leaders in other party were saying at that time. So how this manifests in the Civil War is that at times when Republican and Democratic leaders in the North were in favor of prosecuting the war against the rebels, you see basically no divides in the enlistment patterns of people in Republican and Democratic areas. But at times when the Northern Democrats were in pretty strong opposition to a strong prosecution of the war against Southern Democrats, their previous allies, you see really large gaps in enlistment opening up on the basis of partisanship. So the leaders that people are following, that ordinary partisans are following, tend to be partisan leaders. And when the party leaders in the North were divided on the issue of the war, you see those divides manifest not just in how people looked at the war, but in whether they signed up and risked their lives to fight and to suppress the rebellion.
You point out in the book that Lincoln and others thought he was in serious trouble in his reelection bid in 1864 against General McClellan. But based on hindsight and looking at the numbers, you make the case that it really wasn't in too much doubt.
Yeah, so one of the common questions in political science generally is how ordinary people respond to the costs of war and other things that are going on in political life. And that's a longstanding question that we have been trying to answer historically as well as in the present and across other countries as well. And one of the narratives about the Civil War is that with casualties that were more extreme than any other American conflict, surely that must have been weighing down on Lincoln's chances for re-election. And even at the time, the Lincoln's contemporaries and Lincoln himself thought that he was basically doomed to lose his 1864 re-election bid. But then, seemingly overnight, everything changed. The progress of the Union armies had been slow or stymied entirely in earlier 1864. There had been huge casualties. But then there was a breakthrough in September in which General Sherman and his armies captured Atlanta. General Sheridan was in the Shenandoah Valley having some success as well. And seemingly overnight, the public mood improved dramatically. Many Northerners thought that the election could then be won. That the war could then be won, and therefore that suddenly Lincoln's prospects for re-election were very good, whereas before he had been destined to lose. That is the conventional wisdom, and looking at election data throughout the course of the war, looking at how voters were considering Republicans and Democrats for Congress and for governor, you can actually see that there was not much movement in support for one party or the other over time, even though there was a close correspondence with how people were voting for presidential candidates and those lower level elections. In other words, we can use the voting patterns for Congress and for governor throughout the course of the war that were happening basically every couple of months because elections used to be staggered throughout the calendar at that time. We can use that as a kind of tracking poll almost to see what partisan sentiment was like in the United States through that terrible period. And really we see substantial stability and really very few periods where there's even any deviation from Lincoln basically being on track for re-election. And so the conclusion that I draw from that is at minimum we need to rethink our certainty that there were huge shifts in public mood that had implications for Lincoln's electoral prospects and his party more generally. And a strong version of my argument would be it doesn't look like that made all that much difference, that these enormous events that were taking place during the war didn't seem to register at all with how ordinary people were casting their ballots. And that tells us something more profoundly and generally about the power of partisanship at times where the country is so extremely polarized that people are really responding based on their predispositions to strongly identify with one party or the other, and the other social groups that are in alliance with that party at that time.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Assistant Professor of Political Communication at LSU, Nathan Calmo, former colleague of mine at Monmouth College. He's talking about his new book called Ballots with Ballots and Bullets, Partisanship and Violence in the American Civil War. And he just busted one of the big myths of the Civil War, that Sherman's March to the Sea, it was instrumental in Lincoln's victory. That's one that was new to me, and I think you gave plenty of information there to back up your contention. So I'm finding the older I get that the history I was taught doesn't necessarily align with what really happened, which is interesting, to say the least. One of the interesting things also you tackled, a massive research project, was looking at newspapers at the time. And I bring this up because there's a local angle with a paper called the Davenport Democrat that you used right across the river here. I really thought it was interesting, too, the role leadership played along with political leadership, along with newspapers and influencing people, because back then papers were very partisan. And what role did they play in reinforcing leaders, the partisan views of leaders from both sides?
Yeah, so there's some corollaries with people are familiar with partisan news these days, Fox News, MSNBC, and various websites. But when you think about partisan news in the mid-19th century, it's really quite different than what we have today. You had basically the entire press was partisan. There were only a couple of newspapers here and there that were not just in favor of one party or the other, but actually part of the party organizations themselves, usually bankrolled and run in part by people who were either politicians themselves or were basically political organizers for the party that helped to coordinate those activities. So we're talking about newspapers that are really more like, they're not quite advertisements, because they're still covering the news. They're just putting a spin that is most favorable for their own party in there. So the newspapers are important because they show us what political leaders were thinking and saying at the time, particularly with an eye towards an audience of ordinary people. Some folks don't realize that literacy was actually quite high in the mid-19th century, and so lots of people were reading newspapers. Most towns had, of any size, had at least two newspapers, usually a Democratic paper and a Republican paper, even in places where one party was predominant. And so this gives us a sense of the kinds of messages that leaders were giving to the public, not just through the news, but also the ways that they were framing their appeals in the speeches that they were giving. And we can actually see this in the newspapers, because many of those speeches were printed verbatim or more or less in the newspapers themselves. So the newspapers are important because they're certainly a source of information for the public, but also information that is designed to benefit one party or the other based on the affiliation of that newspaper.
We just had a major controversy in this country over voting by mail. And I didn't realize was that the Civil War had voting by mail, absentee voting among the troops. I think that's a really interesting part of this, and it ties into some of the revisionist history over the role of slavery and the Emancipation Proclamation. But you stake out some pretty strong data there on the political leanings of the troops that I think are a really interesting finding.
Yeah, the early part of the book is talking about how Republicans were more likely on average to respond to calls to enlist, and so that produced a military fighting for the Union that was more Republican than Democratic on average, even more so than the people who were back home and deciding not to participate in that violent conflict. And when we see the voting returns from soldiers who are away in voting in their camps out in the field, they were very disproportionately favoring Republican candidates and Lincoln's reelection, even though their former military commander, George McClellan, was on the ballot against Lincoln in 1864. As an administrative point, you're right that this is actually the first time in American history that you have absentee voting on this scale. Basically, you have, in some cases, 25-35% of the community's electorate going off to war, and so that has huge potential consequences for the outcomes of elections if those people are not allowed to cast absentee ballots. And partisan leaders knew this. They knew that the soldiers were disproportionately Republican, and they sought to use that to their advantage. So in places that were states that were more Democratic, that had Democratic governors and legislatures, those places didn't allow absentee voting because they wanted to disenfranchise those soldiers so that they could gain, that the Democrats in this case could gain advantages for the election. And of course, on the other hand, Republican leaders wanted to give every opportunity for the disproportionately Republican soldiers to be able to cast their ballots absentee. And the Lincoln administration took advantage of its ability to furlough soldiers. That means allowing them to go home for a break in the middle of the war. In places where an election was upcoming and the Democrats in charge locally were not allowing the soldiers to vote absentee. So in a way, you could say both sides were engaged in trying to get electoral advantage in either enfranchising the soldiers to vote absentee or preventing them from doing that. From a normative or principled standpoint, of course, disenfranchising folks is terrible, particularly when they're serving their country. And so Republicans in this case certainly had the high ground of wanting to make sure that everybody who was eligible should be able to cast their ballot, even under extraordinary circumstances like a civil war.
What are the, in your final chapter, you alluded to some of the comparisons with today. And of course, the book was published before the events of a couple weeks ago, which just, I think, further highlights how fragile our democracy is. I think it was a lesson for all of us. But what are some of the lessons for today, Nathan, on for our democracy that can be learned from this book?
Yeah, I think there's several. One of them is that sometimes we think that political rhetoric is just what people say and it doesn't have much impact. So we hear extreme rhetoric and sort of sometimes the most apocalyptic kind of claims coming on what's going to happen if the other side wins. And I think certainly recent events as well as historical events like the Civil War show the consequences of that really grossly exaggerated kind of rhetoric, that it doesn't just roll off people's backs. It motivates people to take increasingly extreme actions, including motivating them into violence. And I think that's a part of mass partisanship among ordinary people that, as political scientists as well as historians, that we have sort of failed to appreciate, which is that with our bias towards the present and towards recent memory, we tend to think of relatively placid partisan politics. But if we look a little bit further back into the past, if we look at examples in other countries, we can see that parties and partisanship can motivate people to take some pretty extreme actions. One other thing that I want to emphasize is the importance of democracy, of having a system of government in which the will of the people ultimately decides who is in charge. Even if that doesn't always make everyone happy, that's still the best way to govern our society in a country that is ultimately run in accordance with the will of the majority, with protections for individual rights. And a really key aspect of that is respecting the results of legitimate elections and for leaders to not wrongly and falsely delegitimize elections that have in fact been freely and fairly contested. That's basically the fundamental factor of keeping a democracy going, is ensuring that everyone accepts the outcome of legitimate elections, even when they're unhappy with the outcome. And if that doesn't happen, then democracy falls apart and we fall into conflict, even into violent conflict. And that's a really scary thing to think about, but that's the reality. And that encourages, that's a weak term, but it encourages politicians to really take their responsibility to the nation seriously, to not mislead the public in these ways, because they have really dangerous consequences.
Well, there's more in this book, and we're not going to have time to get to it, but I really urge folks to take a look, get a copy. There's so much in this that's interesting and applies to current affairs in our country. That it was really a nice touch, too. I saw you dedicated it to two ancestors who had fought in the Civil War, and as somebody, I had a great-grandfather who fought on the Union side. It's a nice touch, and I assume a lot of our listeners had ancestors as well. I wanted to just take, we got about a minute left here. What's next? You've got some interesting other ideas cooking for a next book. Can you share a little bit about what you're going to be looking at next?
Sure. I'm working with Dr. Liliana Mason, who is a political scientist at the University of Maryland. And we're basically doing, in simple terms, we're doing a modern version of the Civil War book. We're recognizing that folks who have studied public opinion for the last 50 or 60 years have not recognized the potential extremes of political views and actions among ordinary people in the American public. And so if we look historically or cross-nationally, you can see some of those extremes. And so we're writing a book called Radical American Partisanship. It'll probably be out in a little over a year. And basically, we're taking the temperature of the public, starting in 2017 and in several surveys from then up through the present, including a lot of data from this current, most recent election, to evaluate how extreme the public is, whether they're changing over time, which kinds of people are more likely to endorse extreme views, and how we can do something about it, both the effects of leaders on inflaming those passions, as well as pacifying them in ways that are healthy for democracy. So overall, we find that something between 10 and 20% of partisans hold really extreme views, including endorsing violence. So most people are rejecting that, but a worrisome portion are seemingly okay with that. And I think that's manifested in some of the actions that you've seen most recently. But there is some hope that leaders can douse some of those flames and hopefully cooler heads can prevail in a direction that isn't just unifying, but is also ultimately defending and expanding democracy.
Well, I say unfortunately only in that it is a relevant topic today, more relevant than we wish. But it's good that we have people like you focusing on this, because it's important to kind of reinstill in the public, I think, what our democracy is all about. So I appreciate you, your work on this. My guest today has been Nathan Calmo, Associate Professor of Political Communication at LSU, Louisiana State University. And Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll look forward to your next book and having you back on as a guest.
Thanks so much, Robin, and thank you to your listeners.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.